I think the legislation should pass, and I think it should be sold. I understand the technology. It's a great business, and I'm going to put together a group to buy TikTok.
You're trying to buy TikTok?
I am, because this should be owned by U.S. businesses. There's no way that the Chinese would ever let a U.S. company own something like this in China.
Have you already put a group together?
No, I'm working
on it. You're exploring a group.
I've spoken to a bunch of people, but...
Who would be part of your group?
I can't tell that to you now.
Former Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin speaking to CNBC today. He wants to buy TikTok after the House yesterday passed a bill that would force its Chinese parent company ByteDance to either sell TikTok or face a ban in the U.S. Some members of Congress view TikTok as a national security threat because it collects data on American users and the software could be controlled by the Chinese government. TikTok says there's no proof Beijing uses it to gather data on American users or that they try to sway American opinion. Still, half the country has TikTok on their phones, and a lot of them regularly get their news from the site. We have two guests now to talk about whether TikTok should be banned or sold and what the national security risk is. Julia Engwin is a Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who writes about tech policy and founded the nonprofit newsroom Proof News. Welcome back, Julia.
It's great to be here.
And Joan Donovan is a journalism professor at Boston University, where she studies online disinformation and media manipulation. Hi, Joan.
Hey, how's it going?
All right, let's begin with you. Any thoughts on Mnuchin putting together this group to buy TikTok, possibly?
It's a natural consequence. I think he's probably not the only person thinking about the potential $25 billion business that it could rain profits in the U.S. If it was forced to be sold essentially to the highest bidder. Unfortunately, there is not substantive proof in any way that the technology itself is being used either as a spyware or that it's being used to cause anti-U.S. sentiment, but I'm not surprised that people's, eyes are lighting up with dollar signs at this moment.
Right. And Julia, you wrote recently that Americans don't agree on much, but they do agree that there should be stronger privacy laws. And they also agree that they don't want TikTok banned because, well, half of them use TikTok. So why is Congress going down this path?
I mean, I have to say it is really surprising to me that in an election year when, President Joe Biden just launched TikTok channel like a month ago to launch his campaign, that the politicians would feel comfortable coming out with a ban at a time when it's really unpopular, right? It's not just unpopular to ban TikTok. It's also extremely popular. People really want whole like baseline comprehensive privacy legislation, which has been stalled at the federal level for years. So instead of delivering what people are begging for, they're flying in the face of that and saying, we're going to ban your favorite app because of sort of unspecified national security concerns during an election year when we are all actually trying to use this and all other methods to get you out to vote.
Mm-hmm. And compare it to other social media apps in terms of how it, infiltrates users' privacy and also feeds them certain topics.
I mean, the thing is that TikTok is very similar to every other app on your phone. It gets the same types of data. It gets where you're located geographically as you connect to the cell tower. It gets how long you're using it, what you're looking at, which is like which videos on TikTok, which videos you've watched. It has less data than other social networks because it doesn't really facilitate private messaging and it's not built around this idea of a friends network as much. And so it doesn't have as much of your contacts, and it also doesn't have, what I have with like Facebook and Google. I have a whole suite of apps that I use of theirs, between Instagram and Google Docs. And so it actually has less data than probably its other social media competitors. But the argument that lawmakers are making is that like China has access to this data and could do something malevolent. The problem is they haven't told us what that malevolent thing is or shown us any proof that it's happening.
Right. As opposed to Russia, which we know what happened in previous elections with Facebook, for example.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about Russia was We know what they did. They actually went and tried to interfere with the election by setting up fake accounts on Facebook. And interestingly, they were pretty successful at creating a lot of chaos and disinformation. And weirdly, they didn't have to buy Facebook to do it, right? Like, the thing about these social media platforms is they are actually, as Jones' research has shown over and over, they are like perfectly designed for networked disinformation. And so essentially everyone is on these platforms trying to promote their agendas, state actors, corporate actors, personal individuals, you know.
Mm-hmm. So Joan, talk a little bit more about that, because there have been reports that TikTok has manipulated the news that people can see, especially with regards to, let's say, the war, the Hamas-Israel mm-hmm. war, maybe putting in more positive Hamas stuff in there, not putting in information about the Uyghurs or Hong Kong democracy protests, things like that.
Yeah, I think it's a good question. And unfortunately, because of the design of TikTok, we don't have a lot of prevalence rates to go off of. But I do, you know, when the October 7th attack happened in Israel, it became very clear to me that many of our lawmakers were very concerned about TikTok in particular, because there was a lot of not necessarily pro-Hamas, but pro-Palestine content, Palestinian liberation content, first-person narratives from Gaza about what was really happening in the moment. And there was this feeling among lawmakers and even journalists that called me that were saying, the ceasefire protests are because of TikTok. And I had to explain to them that it's a lot more than that that goes into organizing in-person events, and that Students for Justice in Palestine had been organizing with Black Lives Matter for the last decade. And so it's not TikTok's, strategy here to make this content more prevalent. It just seems to be the sentiment. And you can see it reflected in these small town protests where people are lined up around the rotary asking for a ceasefire. And but there was this allegation that somehow China was using that as a way, using TikTok as a way to polarize the U.S. and to spread claims that anti-Semitic content was being spread because people had criticisms of the policies of the Israeli government. And what we know about social media and social movements is that when people get angry and they feel outraged and they feel that the government isn't listening to them, that's when they take to the streets. They don't take to the streets just because they saw a video or two on a platform. But what's interesting, I think, over the years in terms of where we see TikTok cross over with disinformation, it's usually that the TikTok video is considered the source. So there was a video circulating during COVID of a train that goes by that says COVID on the side of it. And people were then claiming that this TikTok video was evidence that COVID was being transported by train from city to city in the U.S. So that's where we tend to see the TikTok content is enmeshed in larger, more nuanced media narratives.
But what about this idea of not platforming news regarding to sensitive topics in China, like the Uyghurs or democracy protests?
Yeah, I mean, that is a good question and could be scientifically studied. When we talk about center and left wing media and how they might do disinformation, we do think a lot about omission, the idea mm-hmm. that certain narratives should be prevalent and are missing. But then when you look over on other platforms and you don't see that content, or you do, that's when you can start to make those assessments. And of course, freedom protests in Hong Kong are something that was prevalent on X or Twitter, was prevalent on Facebook. And so not seeing it on TikTok does raise an air of concern. The other thing that TikTok really has honed itself in on is being an app for entertainment and a content platform over a platform that recommends you things that your friends also like. And that can account for some of the variances here. As TikTok is not focused on politics in the same way, or even not focused on journalism in the same way as prior social media platforms.
And Julia, TikTok doesn't own the algorithm. ByteDance, its parent company, does. So if it is sold off, would it be minus its, you know, its key ingredient? And would the American company run by Steve Mnuchin or whoever, would they have to basically reinvent TikTok?
I mean, I'm not aware of that algorithmic distinction, but I trust you that it's correct. But I would say that you really can't operate any of these social media platforms without the algorithm, right? Like, there has to be an algorithm to sort what videos show up at the top. So they would have to build one. And I think a huge amount of the discussion around TikTok and the ban is actually, honestly, it's about the algorithm. It's about the fact that there's this fear that China could use that algorithm to sort of preference its political agenda. What I find sort of surprising about it is that, about the current conversation, is that our answer to that is to hand that algorithm to, like, somebody who was, you know, a leading figure in a political party, right? Like, so we're, mm-hmm. it's not like we're saying, oh, we want it to be neutral. We're just going to hand it to a billionaire who has a political agenda, but he's got a U.S. political agenda. You know, a better solution would be for us as the public to have oversight and more control over our algorithms, the way that Europe has sort of required the companies to give much more transparency about their algorithms and more choice to consumers. But the Congress has not passed a similar law here.
Right. So why don't they do that? And then they could encompass all of the social media companies, not just TikTok. And that would be a lot more protective when it comes to privacy and data manipulation.
I mean, you are not alone in asking that question, right? I mean, there's nothing more popular and more bipartisan popular than passing privacy laws. And the, you know, polls show repeatedly that Americans really want regulation of sort of like unregulated corporate data exploitation market that exists right now. But we haven't seen it. And I think there's probably a couple reasons. One is that the tech companies are big lobbyists. They contribute a lot to politicians' campaigns. They spend a lot of money on lobbying. And they're a huge industry that drives a lot of growth. And I think they've scared a lot of people into thinking that if they're regulated, it could slow down our economy, et cetera. And then I also think what's happened is that there's been a lot of frustration that we don't have a privacy law in this country the way that almost every other nation has. So a lot of states have passed their own laws. So now there's a lot of differences in opinions between states. So some states have stronger laws and some regulate some things, some don't. And so it's gotten a lot more complicated to figure out what, like, how it would look to harmonize all those laws at the federal level.
Okay. And very quickly, we have just a couple seconds left. What do you think the chances are that this actually becomes law? Because Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer seems a little ambivalent.
I mean, I feel like they're facing a really big backlash from the TikTok constituency, who is apparently flooding congressional offices with calls. And so my sense is that the Senate is maybe pausing and thinking twice about whether they want to move forward with this.
Julia Angwin, Pulitzer Prize-winning investigative journalist who writes about tech policy, and she also founded the nonprofit newsroom Proof News, and Joan Donovan, professor of journalism at Boston University. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Well, speaking of surveillance, coming up, how your car may be spying on you and selling that data to your insurance company. Also, we will have your weekend movie reviews later on. Those stories coming up next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Your car may be collecting and sharing data with insurance companies about your driving habits, like how fast you accelerate, how hard you brake. GM, Honda, Kia, they're all doing it, possibly other automakers. The result, some drivers' insurance premiums have gone up without explanation. Tech reporter Kashmir Hill wrote about this for the New York Times. Welcome back.
Thanks, Madeline.
How are they doing this? How are they collecting this data?
Well, if you bought your car in the last 5 years, it is collecting all kinds of data. And if you've connected your car, if you have connected services, and that means you have like a navigation screen in the car, or you can call for roadside assistance from your car, that means your car has a cellular connection or Wi-Fi connection, and it is sending data out somewhere back to the automaker.
And then how is the automaker sending it on to our insurance companies?
Well, this can vary from automaker to automaker. The ones that I focused on in the story, number one was General Motors. And what's happening with General Motors is that there is a program that you can access through their app called Smart Driver. And it's a program to make yourself a better driver. It says, you know, it'll give you feedback. It'll give you digital badges when you drive well. You can be a brake genius or a speed limit hero. And so some people turn this on to get this kind of feedback, to get these badges, and didn't realize that when they turned it on, they were giving permission for their data to be shared with LexisNexis, a big data broker, and Verisk, another data broker. And both these data brokers work with insurance companies. So they were getting the data. And I started to see people, I was kind of lurking in car forums because I wanted to look at data collection by cars. And I saw people saying that their insurance rates were going up by 20%, by 50%, doubling. And when they asked why, the agents were telling them, request your LexisNexis consumer disclosure report. And when they did that, they saw that LexisNexis had all this data about every trip they'd taken in their cars, how far they'd driven, when the trip started, when it ended, and yeah, how many times they had hit the brakes, rapidly accelerated, or sped.
Wow. And this is all without the driver's knowledge or permission.
So, you know, some of these drivers had turned on Smart Driver. And so they at least knew that they were getting this feedback, but they would have had no way of knowing that it was going to data brokers. It wasn't really prominently disclosed in any way. And I asked General Motors, you know, how do you disclose this? How are you getting permission to do this? And they pointed to OnStar's privacy policy. OnStar is the connected services for GM's car. And there's a little section about, you know, how GM shares information with third parties when they have business contracts with them. And it gives, as an example, SiriusXM. Like if you have SiriusXM turned on in your car, SiriusXM is getting data about you. But it did not mention Smart Driver, did not mention LexisNexis or Verisk or insurance companies in any way. On top of that, some of the people who had Smart Driver turned on, whose data was getting, you know, reported out to LexisNexis, they say they didn't turn it on. Some of them had never even heard of Smart Driver before. And so they did not opt into this program. And I did come across a company manual from GM where they described giving bonuses to salespeople, you know, at car dealerships if they get people to enroll in OnStar. And that can include Smart Driver. So it may be that when these people bought their vehicles, the salesman was kind of turning it on for them and they had no idea.
Oh, my gosh. Well, is that illegal? Or I don't know if any laws are being broken, but does it violate any consumer protection laws or anything like that?
Yeah, it's a good question. I talked to Senator Edward Markey of Massachusetts for this story. He's really been asking a lot of questions about, you know, what data your cars are collecting and who they're sharing it with. And I described to him what was happening with GM, the fact that this data was getting collected from cars, resulting in people's insurance rates being raised. And he said, wow, that really sounds like a violation of the law that protects people from unfair and deceptive business practices. And that's something that that's a law that is enforced by the Federal Trade Commission. And he has been urging the FTC to investigate automakers. And if this has happened to anybody, there is a complaints line with the FTC. And you can go and say, hey, this happened to me. And I don't think this is a fair you know, fair business practice. They can lodge a complaint for it if they consider it to be fraud. So if there's listeners that discover this has happened to them, that is a place that you can go to tell the government about it.
The FTC. How do you even find out if this is happening, if they're collecting your data and selling it?
Yeah, so I have a news you can use box at the end of the story. One thing you can do is if you have a car app, look at that car app. See if you have something like this turned on, a driver score, driver feedback, smart driver when it comes to GM. And yeah, see if you're enrolled and if they're collecting this data about you. And then the other two things is that you can go to LexisNexis. You can go to Verisk and you can request your consumer file and you can see whether your driving data is something that they have or they have purchased. So I really encourage people to do that. And they may find other interesting data. I mean, I requested my LexisNexis file. It didn't have my driving data, but it did have me associated with my sister's email address from high school in the 90s. And so that was one of many weird things that was in my report. And so I think it's just a good thing to look at for anybody, even if you don't have a car.
You know, who knew this was happening? I thought LexisNexis was used in newsrooms in the 90s. Speaking of, that's when I used it just to do news searches.
Yeah. I mean, LexisNexis said they're not giving insurance companies the individualized trip data, but they said we are giving a score. And that's what they are sharing with insurance companies. And they also said that you give consent to this because when you are applying for auto insurance, you know, getting quotes from different companies, those companies often ask you to approve getting third-party reports. And if you do that, then that says to LexisNexis, okay, we're approved to give them this whole big, you know, file about you or your driving score. Though I do think California has a law that prohibits them specifically from getting your credit score.
Okay. Wow. Total caveat emptor. But, you know, a lot of people read these things or don't read these things more to the point and just click, I agree, to get whatever they want, the service that they're signing up for. It is not necessarily made, as you have reported, apparent to the person, the driver who's signing up for one of these services.
And this kind of model comes from the internet, you know, Google, Facebook, surveillance capitalism. For so long, it was, you know, you get a free email account, you get a free social network account, and those companies kind of monetize your data, your eyeballs. But that model of surveillance capitalism is now spreading to other companies. And that's what automakers are doing. They're saying, okay, we sold you this car. Great. But we could also make money off of selling your data or selling access to your data.
But could it lead to safer driving? Like once your insurance rates go up, wouldn't you maybe be a better driver if you found out why?
If you found out why, yeah. I've talked to this one law professor and he's studied this and he said, yeah, people drive better when they know that they're being watched. But that's not what this is. People don't know that they're being monitored. They don't know that they're being watched. You know, they're just paying more for it without us all getting the improvement to our safety. So this is kind of the worst possible way to do it.
Wow. Okay. So GM is making millions of dollars selling this data. But as you say, Honda is also doing it. Kia. Do we know how many automakers are doing this?
Yeah. So one thing I did in the story is I looked at, you know, LexisNexis and Verisk. They call this the telematics exchange. And they listed some of the automakers that are partners in these exchanges. And so I reached out to those companies like Honda, like Kia, like Subaru. And it's different from automaker to automaker. But yeah, with Honda, with Kia, with Hyundai, with Mitsubishi, they have these features in their app called driver score or driver feedback or driver scoring. And yes, if you turn them on, you are in most cases saying, yes, I want this feedback. And yes, you can provide this to data brokers. In fact, it's often the data broker that is giving you the score in the app that's doing the scoring for you, even though you might think it's Honda or Kia. And some of them disclose this more than others. Sometimes it requires going to the website that describes the feature, or reading the privacy policy closely or reading the FAQ about the tool. I don't think it's too obvious to people that's what they're signing up for.
Oh, creepy. Christine had nothing on these cars. Kashmir Hill, tech reporter for the New York Times. Thank you.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for spreading the word about it.
Monday on Press Play, we'll speak with a Santa Monica woman. In the 1970s, she was a rock and roll photographer. She's out now with a new book featuring her work with Bob Marley, Joni Mitchell, Graham Parsons. She has lots of stories, so that will be on the show on Monday. Coming up, we'll have your weekend movie reviews.
I mean, if you've ever wanted to see Brian Cox threaten Brooklyn Prince over a missing pigeon, this is the movie for you.
All right, that's next on Press Play. This is 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. The Oscars are behind us. Time to move on to some new movies. And here to help us do that are William Bibbiani and Katie Walsh. Bibbs is film critic and co-host of the Critically Acclaimed Network. And Katie Walsh reviews films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Welcome back to both of you.
Ahoy, ahoy.
Thank you.
Ahoy, ahoy. Okay, first up, the serious film today. A true story about a London stockbroker who saved hundreds of Jewish children from Nazi-occupied Czechoslovakia during World War II. This is called One Life, and it stars Sir Anthony Hopkins.
Nikki, you must know we cannot save them all. You have to forgive yourself that.
We started, sir. I have to finish it.
Okay, babes, this is based on a true story about a man named another Sir Nicky Winton. And most people have probably never heard of him, but this movie sounds a little bit like Schindler's List. Tell us more about the plot.
So Nicholas Winton, as you mentioned, he was a stockbroker in London in the late 1930s. And when he found out about the German occupation of Czechoslovakia and how many children were at severe risk of being, killed. He decided he had to do something about it. It's a hell of a story. And Anthony Hopkins plays the older Nicholas Winton. Johnny Flynn plays him as a younger man. Helena Bonham Carter plays his mother. And this is the kind of movie that you would want to show if you wanted people to know about this part of history. It is not, unfortunately, in itself a particularly dazzling or suspenseful, captivating movie. It's perfectly fine. It's a nice film if you want to get this history lesson. And if you know the story of Nicholas Winton, and you might, you know that it has a great ending. Like, the actual conclusion of the movie, the climax, is very memorable. But everything leading up to it is basically, here's what happened.
All right, Katie, this is directed by James Hawes, and he has directed television, most notably the Black Mirror series and the Slow Horses series in Britain. This is his first feature film. And what did you think of his performance?
Yeah, I think this is actually like a very quietly moving film. I agree with Bibbs that in the first half, it feels very sort of standard issue, like, we've seen this story before, like the iconography is very familiar, the story beats. There's not a lot of explaining why the younger Nicholas Winton was so compelled to go. There's not really like any sort of psychological motivation beyond the fact that he just felt like this was something that he had to do out of, you know, the values of decency and kindness that he was raised with. But I think what's really compelling about this story is sort of the second half, which is the Sir Anthony Hopkins half, where he, you know, he's found this scrapbook of his time working in Czechoslovakia with photographs of the children. And he's sort of like, well, I don't know if this was a good thing I did or not. You know, I guess it matters or it doesn't. And I think the more interesting part of the story is how people came to recognize him and the importance of the work that he did, and that saving 600 children would actually turn into, you know, saving a generation of people and the amount of lives that he has affected. So it was one of those movies that really crept up on me in a very subtle and like quietly effective way. It's not trying to be too a sensationalist about this type of material, which I kind of appreciated from James Hawes.
Yeah. Okay. One Life in theaters in wide release beginning today. Now begins the animal theme portion of our film review segment. Next up, another one based on a true story, an adventure film called Arthur the King, starring Mark Wahlberg as part of a racing team that accidentally adopts a stray dog named Arthur along the race.
You want to start to embrace the buckets of pain?
I need a bigger bucket.
Team Broad Rail has traveled over 200 miles. And they found a companion.
Daddy has a dog?
What have you done?
Think you found your new partner in suffering, Michael.
Yeah, he's the king.
I think we should call him Arthur.
Arthur the king.
Okay, Katie, you saw this one. And this is a true story, I guess. It's based on a true story about a dog who manages to somehow follow this racing team on a 400 plus mile race through the wilderness. In real life, it was Ecuador. In the movie, it's the Dominican Republic. What did you think?
It's a dog movie. You'd have to be a complete, you know, jerk to not, you know, shed a tear because, you know, we don't deserve dogs. Dogs are just perfect creatures. But yeah, this is kind of like a sort of odd human interest sports quirky story that has become this sort of like media sensation. And it also is a film about a very niche sport I had never heard of, which was adventure racing, where you hike and mountain bike and trek and run and kayak like over the course of 5 days, and the dog follows them and becomes like their mascot and their motivator, and even has a couple Lassie moments where he's barking at the team like, don't fall in that ravine kind of situation. And this, I just want to say, is very much a Mark Wahlberg movie. He's a deeply devout Catholic who wakes up at like 3 a.m. to work out. So this movie could not be more up his alley, I think. And he's also really into this idea of like salvation through suffering, which is a very Catholic idea. And in the trailer clip you played, he sort of says like, embrace the pain, the buckets of pain. And he keeps talking about suffering and pain and how, you know, through physical degradation, this is kind of how you achieve transcendence. And so yeah, it's a very much an adventure dog movie, many of which we have seen before since the advent of cinema. And it is very much a Mark Wahlberg movie in that it is about the themes that he loves to embrace.
Arthur the King in wide release beginning today. Moving on, we have a French thriller. It's called The Animal Kingdom, and it's a story of a father and son trying to survive in a world where a virus, sound familiar, is causing humans to mutate.
Non mais les gens ont peur, qu'est-ce que tu veux? Donc ça sert à rien de les enfermer. On va apprendre à vivre ensemble.
N'aie pas peur.
C'est ta mère, Emile.
Okay, so one character is saying there, people are afraid, it's pointless, locking them up, learn to live together. Another says, don't be afraid, she's your mother. I guess the mom, Bibbs, has transformed into something otherworldly. Human.
Actually quite worldly, but not human. This movie takes place in a world just like your own, except in the relatively recent past. People, and they're not sure if it's a virus or exactly what causes it, but people have started randomly mutating into half human, half animal creatures. It could be any animal. We see wolves, chameleons, hawks, snakes. The visual effects are really quite lovely and astounding. This movie, we just had the Academy Awards here in America. Well, they just had the Academy Awards in France, too. And while Anatomy of a Fall won Best Picture, was kind of the Oppenheimer of the evening, The Animal Kingdom was kind of like the poor things. It really took home a lot of the technical awards. And it's easy to see why. It's realization of this kind of strange, you know, half power fantasy, half cautionary tale about how we treat people who are different in the environment would be realized. It's really quite lovely to look at. story-wise, it's a story of a man whose wife has turned into one of these animal creatures, and his son starts transforming into one as well, and he doesn't tell his father for a long time, and he starts to realize that, you know, these creatures might not be monstrous, maybe there's actually something beautiful about them. I think a lot of Americans would expect a story like this to really kick into high gear and get into serious action territory, and while there is some definitely very thrilling and unusual sequences of action and peril, this is a much more thoughtful take on this kind of fantasy genre. And I really got swept up in it. I think this is really quite remarkable. I think as a sort of a metaphor, as an allegory, it's a little vague to the point of maybe not being as useful as it could be in a real world application. But in terms of just dunking us into this world of a very distinct version of, you know, fantasy and monsters, it's quite remarkable, and I enjoyed it a lot, and I'd recommend it.
Okay. Katie, seems like it is an apt metaphor for COVID and other things. What did you think?
I loved this film. I agree with Bibbs. I was very captivated by it. The world building is really amazing, and also the visual effects are just stunning. I actually think the metaphor is like very obvious and profound. I sort of looked at it as a metaphor for anybody that we consider other and sort of try to persecute and make force them to either live in a contained world. There's this sort of threat of like a big concrete like facility where they're going to put all the quote unquote critters, as they keep calling them, and what it means to, you know, try to control people's bodies who are, you know, uncontrollable. Like they can't control whether or not they turn into the creatures. So is it better to, you know, violently force them to be hidden from view, or to just let them live in this verdant, peaceful world that they kind of established for themselves? And you know, I think it's, you know, I was looking at it very much as like a queer metaphor, like a trans metaphor. I thought it was, you know, but I think it's open enough that anybody can kind of use this film to represent what they, you know, what they want to represent. I loved this. I love that it's sort of a French domestic drama rather than a thriller or action film. And Romain Duris plays the father. He is so good. And the son is played by a kid named Paul Kircher. He is absolutely terrific as well. Great performance. The score is beautiful. It also won a César Award, which is the French Oscars. And yeah, I think this film is great.
The Animal Kingdom in limited release beginning today, and you can see it at the Alamo Draft House in downtown LA. Finally, another animal flick, a coming-of-age film called Little Wing. It stars The Florida Project's Brooklyn Prince and Succession's Brian Cox. Yes, Logan Roy himself. It's about a 13-year-old whose family crisis pulls her into the world of pigeon racing.
We're getting a divorce.
Can I have a phone?
I owe $100,000 on the house.
If I had that money, I'd buy this house and kick everyone out.
Have you ever heard of racing pigeons?
There's this dude. One of his birds is valued at $120,000.
Wait, where does this pigeon dude live?
Here, in Portland.
Boom.
All right, Katie, this is loosely based on a New Yorker article by Susan Orlean. Tell us more about what happens to Brooklyn Prince's character, Caitlin, and what you thought of this movie.
Yeah, I mean, if you've ever wanted to see Brian Cox threaten Brooklyn Prince over a missing pigeon, this is the movie for you.
I did want that. I didn't know I wanted that, but I do now.
If you remember Brooklyn Prince, she was so adorable and sweet and heartbreaking in The Florida Project, which came out in 2017. She's still a really, really terrific actress. I liked this film a lot. I kind of thought, you know, going in, I'm like, oh, it's going to be kind of like a treacly, like heartwarming tale about a girl and this older figure. It's actually quite a bit edgier than I expected. The director is Dean Israelite, and he really brings like a very sort of like thriller aspect to this. What could have been quite, you know, cheesy is actually pretty interesting, you know, thanks to the actors who are terrific. And then also the director who really brings an interesting, darker edge to the film. One of the things I love about this movie is the soundtrack is so good. She's obsessed with Kathleen Hanna. So there's all these Riot Girl songs on Bikini Kill, La Tigra songs on the soundtrack, and just made it, gave it a flavor of being something a little bit more interesting. So I did enjoy this one.
Bibbs?
Yeah, I'm with Katie all the way. I love this movie. I feel like this movie kind of got snuck out there. It didn't get a big push. It's on Paramount Plus exclusive. And I see people talking about, like, hey, where are all the good coming-of-age stories of our generation? And I'm like, here's one. They barely want you to see it. I love that Dean Israelite took this Susan Orlean story, which it would, if you just, you know, dealt with it directly, just be a story about a kid who got into pigeon racing, and that would have been lovely in its own right. And he was like, what if there were heists? And that's such a great addition. That's such a fun, I got really swept up in it. I thought this was going to be Fly Away Home. It's got spunk, it's got humor, it's got love. It isn't afraid to tackle some actually kind of dark subject material for kids. I laughed, I was moved. I really do think this is one of the better coming of age stories I've seen in years, and I really hope it doesn't get lost in the shuffle.
William Bibbiani is film critic and co-host of the podcasts Canceled Too Soon and critically acclaimed Katie Walsh Reviews Films for the Tribune News Service and the Los Angeles Times. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Is that your pigeon?
I'm pretty cool.
All right. Thank you both. Take care. Oh, he does make a mean pigeon. Former President Trump is in court again today. He's seeking dismissal of criminal charges related to classified and top secret documents he allegedly withheld and concealed from investigators at Mar-a-Lago. We'll have updates on the case at 1 o'clock right here on 89.9 KCRW. Coming up, happy Pie Day. Evan Kleiman, the pie queen herself, is here with a pie to celebrate. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on 89.9 KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. It is Pi Day, the annual celebration of the mathematical ratio, 3.14, and as good a reason as any to bake a real pie. Time now for Press Play's weekly food segment with our very own pie queen, Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. She's here to tell us what makes a good vegan pie. Hello.
Hello.
I have to say, a lot of people don't think those two words go well together, vegan and pie. But you're here to tell us otherwise.
Well, it is a challenge and it requires skill and practice. I've had a lot of not delicious vegan pie.
Yeah, I know. Me too. Well, we're gonna talk about what makes a really delicious vegan pie. But first, let's just talk about 314 and not just a day for math nerds, a day for pie nerds. Tell us.
Yes, we are launching. We are making the announcement about our annual pie contest today, and the website should be live for bakers to go on and enter.
All right. Exciting. And when is the actual event?
The actual event is April 28th.
Okay. So they've got some time to get their pies in order, so to speak. And one of the categories is vegan pie, and you are not as pleased with the entrance usually with vegan pies, right?
I'm always very befuddled when I look at the vegan entries because I don't think people thought through enough, you know, the time it was going to take them to transport the pie, how long it would be sitting out waiting for people to judge it. The hardest part about making a vegan pie is stabilizing the filling. I've always wondered why people just don't make a fruit pie.
Right, exactly. You don't need to worry about it if it's just fruit. That's naturally vegan.
Yeah, and it's the easiest pie to veganize because all you need to worry about is the crust, which is relatively the easiest part of the pie to make vegan these days. I'm not saying that every person who enters should make a fruit pie, but I've always looked at the entries and gone, how bizarre that there aren't fruit pies.
Maybe people are overthinking it. Okay, well, let's talk about the crust, because I always put butter in my crust, obviously not vegan. So how do you get around that?
Well, I mean, right now there are many vegan plant butters. And, you know, when I was a child and I was learning how to make pie as a kid, everybody used Crisco. A lot of people still use Crisco in their pies.
But that's lard, right?
No, Crisco's not lard. It's vegetable shortening.
Oh.
And it is really stable and it gives you a beautiful flaky result. Now, if you prefer to go with a smaller company, I completely get that. Earth Balance sticks, not the tub, are also really great. They give you a really good pie. But there are a lot of options now. What I would do if I were going to make it is I would go to the store, I would buy all the plant butters, and I would just make crust with each of them and see which one I liked the best and which one my recipe worked best with. And then I would choose that for the pie contest.
There is also another ingredient a lot of chefs are using made out of cocoa butter. Tell us about that.
Yeah, there's this new plant butter that has been developed by these two women who are very high-level pastry chefs. One is a pastry chef who has worked at Madison Park. And so she set out to create a vegan butter that she felt was delicious enough and worked well enough in the application she needed to be able to laminate properly, you know, so she could make not just pie dough, but croissants and other things. And this company is called Terlami. Unfortunately, the butter is not yet available retail, but you could buy a case of it through the website Websterant. And the thing that makes this butter different and interesting is that it's made by a mixture of cocoa butter and coconut oil. And cocoa butter has a higher melting point, which gives you something more like butter and less like coconut oil, which melts too quickly, which is why a lot of times you don't get good flakiness just using coconut oil.
All right. Can you make this combination yourself, or do you have to buy it from this company, Terlami?
Well, I mean, Terlami is the gold standard. And if you're curious and you're a home baker, this is definitely something you want to look for. But I spoke to Jennifer Yee, who's the baker at Baker's Bench. She's been lauded in town for her vegan croissants. And she said what she would do is she would start to experiment at home by creating her own butter with a combination of cocoa butter and coconut oil. And she would start with a ratio of 75% coconut oil and 25% cocoa butter. I've written down the instructions that she told me for the web for people who are interested. But again, because that isn't a super strict recipe, people will have to experiment with ratios. Don't make a recipe once and think it's going to be good enough to win the contest.
All right. You're not fooling around here. This is serious business. You got to make good pies if you want to win.
I mean, the judges are critical. That's their job. They're
and
judging.
There are a lot of pies to choose from and a lot fall by the wayside.
It's true.
Okay. So what about tofu? Because when you think vegan, you think tofu. Can you use that in a pie somehow?
Yeah, for fillings, definitely. For crust, no. Tofu often can take the place of eggs and other creamy dairy and pie fillings and works really, really well, as does cashews, using cashews for making a cream-like substance.
And aquafaba as well?
Aquafaba, you know, I can't speak to how well aquafaba holds up, you know? When you beat it to death and it makes those beautiful billows like meringue, they're fantastic. But somebody would have to make their pie and then really let it hang around for a couple of hours and see if it was still great at the end of that time.
Okay, sounds great. Looking forward to the pie contest. And what is on Good Food this week?
A couple of the segments we have for you this week are, we talked to a sous chef who works at Pidja Palace, who is an observant Muslim, and we talked to him what it's like being a chef during Ramadan. And we talked to a cookbook author who wrote a really fantastic book about cooking gluten-free.
Hmm. What's it called?
Eat and Enjoy Gluten-Free.
Ah, okay. So the whole book is in the title, I guess.
There you go. It was a really fun conversation.
All right. Look forward to that. You can listen to KCRW's Good Food every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. Or you can subscribe to the podcast and also Evan's newsletter at kcrw.com/goodfood. Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food, thank you.
Thank you so much, Madeline.
Again, the Pie Fest, April 28th, and community events like Pie Fest are really the heart of KCRW. So today, step up to protect them with a donation. Today only, your dollars will go twice as far. Donate now and have your gift matched up to $10,000 by KCRW champions Ashley and David Kramer and Jeanette Patrick and Mila Nulty. So let's say if you give $157, that's pretty precise, it becomes $314 for KCRW. So you'll also be entered to win a VIP experience at Pie Fest. Don't miss out. It's Pi Day. Donate before midnight at kcrw.com/give. And that does it for this week on Press Play. Our producers are Angie Perrin, Bennett Person, Nihar Patel, Zeke Reed, Jack Ross, and Kelsey Gante. Brian Hardzinski is our line editor. Amy Ta, our digital editor. Sarah Sweeney, our managing producer. Our technical director is Super Mario Saavedra. I'm Madeline Brand, and thanks for listening.